In 1972, two strangers met by chance. A disgraced music professor searching for meaning, and a nurse obsessed with astrology and divine prophecy. Within hours, they became convinced that they had shared cosmic destiny. They weren't just ordinary people. They were chosen beings, sent to prepare humanity for the next level. That meeting would give birth to Heaven's Gate, a movement that began as a spiritual quest but ended in the largest mass suicide on U.S. soil. But before the bunk beds, the purple shrouds, and the Hale-Bopp comet, there was a man, a woman, and a revelation that would change everything. In this episode, we trace the origins of Heaven's Gate, from Marshall Applewhite's battles with faith and identity to Bonnie Nettle's belief in celestial guidance. We explore how their bond evolved into a religious movement, how they recruited their first followers, and how their message morphed from spiritual enlightenment into a strict apocalyptic cult. By the end, we'll see how a fateful meeting between two seekers set the stage for one of the most infamous tragedies in modern history. This is Scarlet Tavern.
Tink.
Tink.
Once again, forgetting our glasses. All right, Heaven's Gate. So, when we did this last time, I had talked to Heaven's Gate when we did this in our first season.
Without consulting me.
Did they even respond back?
They responded already.
I wonder if I can still find it in my email.
Oh, Jesus. I'm scared to know what they said.
If I remember correctly, they didn't say anything weird.
It may not be here anymore.
Let's just count our blessings.
Because I looked up their website. It's very plain.
It's
1990s.
Yeah, that's how all websites were like in the 1990s.
But they did update their... They do have a suicide policy on there.
There's a...
It's not a note.
There's people still taking care of the website. You can email them and then you can buy like their book and stuff.
Yeah. Let's see.
Yeah, this is one of the things I actually remember when this happened. Like, I actually saw this on the news. I was a kid.
Yeah, so like if you go to heavensgate.com, you can still see everything.
Yeah, it says our position against suicide, and then they have a letter.
Yeah.
About against suicide.
Late.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. They actually say do not commit suicide now.
Well, yeah, after they realize, fuck, we don't have anybody anymore.
So, we're again talking about Heaven's Gate. I mean, technically you can still contact these people. I contacted them, said I was doing a podcast and all that. I forget what questions I asked them, but they were very vague with everything. But there are still people that
at least maintain the website.
Yep.
I would be very surprised if they're actual like cult members.
They were.
They are. Oh. They still are.
Yeah, they were. They were chosen to stay behind to run the website, if I remember the research correctly.
So, before he became the leader of Heaven's Gate, Marshall Herf Applewhite Jr. was just another man struggling to find his place in this world. His early life seemed unremarkable, even privileged. He was born on May 17th, 1931 in Spur, Texas, small town with a strong sense of community, faith, and traditional values. His father, Marshall Herf Applewhite Sr., was a Presbyterian minister who held strict religious beliefs and expected his son to follow in his footsteps. From a young age, Applewhite was known for his charisma. He had an authoritative voice, a natural gift for public speaking, and an innate ability to command attention, qualities that would later define his leadership in Heaven's Gate. He was also a talented musician, drawn to opera and theatrical performance. His religious upbringing and artistic ambitions created a contradiction within him, one that would shape the rest of his life. As a young man, Applewhite attended Austin College, where he majored in philosophy. His studies were meant to prepare him for a career in the ministry, but something inside him resisted that path. Instead, his passion for music grew, and he earned a reputation as an engaging and animated performer. After graduation in 1952, he briefly attended Union Presbyterian Seminary in Richmond, Virginia, but he never completed his religious studies. He left seminary, abandoning his original career path, and chose to pursue music instead. This decision was the first major turning point in his life. After leaving the seminary, Applewhite's focus turned to music and education. He became a well-regarded music teacher, eventually taking a position as a professor at the University of St. Thomas in Houston, Texas. He was a dynamic instructor, beloved by his students for his passionate lectures, dramatic personality, and stylish presence. He was also deeply religious, though not in the conventional sense. He often questioned traditional Christian teachings, seeking deeper, more esoteric meanings in theology. But beneath his confident, charismatic exterior, Applewhite was a man torn apart by inner conflicts. His biggest struggle was his sexuality. He had same-sex attractions, something that clashed violently with his religious upbringing. Throughout his life, Applewhite attempted to suppress his desires, believing them to be sinful and in conflict with God's plan. In an effort to conform, he married Ann Pierce, a woman he had met during his college years. Together, they had two children, and for a while, he seemed to live the ideal family life. But Applewhite's marriage was built on denial and repression. He had affairs with male students and struggled with immense guilt over his inability to reconcile his sexual identity with his faith. The tension between who he was and who he felt he was supposed to be gnawed at him relentlessly. The breaking point came in 1965 when he was allegedly caught in an inappropriate relationship with a male student at the University of Alabama, where he was teaching at the time. Of course, it was Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
Might as well have been his cousin. The scandal led to his immediate dismissal. His wife, who had long suspected of his affairs, decided to end their marriage. She took their children and cut nearly all ties with him. Applewhite was devastated. His marriage was over, his teaching career was in shambles, and he had nowhere to turn. The guilt, shame, and loss of identity sent him into a deep depression, one that would shape the rest of his life.
And Marshall was also drafted into the United States Army in 1954.
Oh.
He served in Austria and New Mexico as a member of the Army Signal Corps.
He was a commo.
That's when he left the military in 1956 and enrolled at the University of Colorado. That's where he earned a master's degree in music. And him and his wife had two children.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know it said two.
Yeah, it did.
Okay. But yeah.
By the late 1960s, Applewhite was a lost man. He drifted between jobs, taking small roles as a musical director and choral director or choral conductor, but nothing lasted. He was still deeply religious, but his experiences had led him to question traditional Christianity more than ever. Then, in 1970, his father died. His father had been a dominant figure in his life, someone who had both inspired and burdened him. Applewhite had spent much of his youth trying to meet his father's expectations as a man, a minister, a husband, and a believer, but he had failed at nearly all of it. When his father passed, Applewhite's grief pushed him to the edge. He suffered what many believe was a severe nervous breakdown, marking the beginning of a period of extreme mental instability. At times, he would vanish for weeks, wandering from city to city, taking on odd jobs to survive. He later claimed that during this time, he experienced a series of visions and mystical revelations, messages that told him he had a greater purpose. He became obsessed with spirituality, New Age ideas, and extraterrestrial life. One thing became clear to him. His suffering was no accident. It was part of something bigger. Hmm. By 1972, Applewhite had reached his lowest point. He was unemployed, burdened by debt, and increasingly detached from reality. He felt as though his life had been wiped clean, as if he were no longer the man he had once been. Then, in what he later described as a cosmic event, he met Bonnie Nettles. I will say Bonnie Nettles is the entire reason for Heaven's Gate.
Yes.
Without her, Heaven's Gate would not exist.
Nope.
Their meeting was serendipitous, almost surreal. Some accounts say he was visiting a sick friend at a hospital where Nettles worked, while others claim he was admitted to the hospital himself for psychiatric treatment. That's what I believe. Whatever the case, from the moment they met, something clicked. Nettles was a devout believer in astrology and mysticism. She was convinced that higher beings had chosen her for a special mission, one that she believed Applewhite was destined to be a part of. She told him that extraterrestrials had foretold their meeting and that together they had a divine role to fulfill. For Applewhite, it was a revelation. He had spent years adrift, drowning in guilt, confusion, and self-doubt. But in Nettles, he found someone who saw him differently, not as a failure, but as a prophet. That day, Applewhite's identity changed forever. Marshall Applewhite's life had been a series of contradictions. A man caught between faith and doubt, desire and repression, failure and destiny. He had been searching for meaning, for purpose, for a reason to believe that his suffering had not been in vain. When he met Bonnie Nettles, it felt like an answer to a question he had been asking his entire life. Together, they would embark on a spiritual journey that would lead to the creation of one of the most infamous religious movements in history. They would soon begin traveling the country, spreading a radical new message, one that combined Christianity, New Age beliefs, and extraterrestrial salvation. They would abandon their old lives, take on new names, and convince hundreds of people that the world was about to end and that they alone held the key to salvation. He was no longer Marshall Applewhite, the failed professor. He was Doe, the messenger of the next level. And his mission was just beginning. And yes, you heard that right. His name was Doe. D-O.
Doe!
That was the name given to him by the extraterrestrials.
Yep. I think there was another. Doe was the second nickname he got.
We'll go through them.
Yeah.
If you wrote this right, they should be in here. Because they're significant. So, let's talk about T. T.I. Bonnie Nettles. T. Before Bonnie Nettles became T, before she was the co-founder of Heaven's Gate, she was a woman fascinated by mysticism, astrology, and the unknown. Unlike Marshall Applewhite, whose past was defined by guilt, repression, and instability, Nettles had an unwavering confidence in the unseen. She believed the universe was alive with messages, and she had dedicated much of her life to deciphering those signs. By the time she met Applewhite in 1972, she had already lost faith in traditional religion, had distanced herself from her family, and was immersed in esoteric teachings, seances, and spiritual visions. She believed she had been guided to Applewhite by forces beyond human understanding, and Applewhite, lost in searching, believed her. But who was Bonnie Nettles before she became the mystical force behind Heaven's Gate? Bonnie Lou Nettles was born August 29th, 1921 in Houston, Texas. And that's the first issue. She was born in Houston. Hmm. Unlike Applewhite, who grew up under the shadow of strict Christian doctrine, Nettle's childhood was relatively ordinary. She was raised Baptist. That's thing wrong number two. But her connection to traditional Christianity was never strong. Instead, she developed an early curiosity about the mystical and the unknown. As a young woman, she took what seemed like a conventional path. She became a registered nurse, married a businessman named Joseph Nettles, and started a family. Over the course of their marriage, they had four children, and by all outward appearances, she was a devoted wife and mother. And from all research I've done, a very successful nurse. Hmm. She was well-liked by her patients, a well-awarded. This was obviously before Daisy Awards and stuff like that, but she was a good nurse. But inside, Bonnie Nettles was restless. While her husband built a career, she immersed herself in spiritual exploration. She read about theosophy, astrology, and reincarnation. She attended seances, believing she could communicate with spirits and otherworldly entities. She spent hours consulting fortune tellers, looking for clues about her destiny. As time went on, her obsession with the mystical deepened, putting a strain on her marriage. She spoke of divine messages, told her children that the world was on the verge of a great change, and insisted that she was receiving guidance from celestial beings. Her most significant belief was that she was communicating with a 19th century monk named Brother Francis, who she claimed whispered wisdom to her from beyond the grave. She saw herself as a spiritual seeker, someone meant to uncover hidden truths about life, the universe, and human existence. But her husband didn't see a mystic. He saw a woman slipping into something dangerous. By the late 1960s, Bonnie Nettles' interest in spirituality had become her life's focus. She was no longer just reading about astrology, she was practicing it, using star charts to interpret people's fates. She began to predict events, telling friends that she could see glimpses of the future. Oh, I know somebody's star chart she could use. We know somebody's star chart she could use.
Who's?
Who did we Betty just talk Hill. About that made a star yeah. chart?
Betty Hill.
Oh, yeah.
Betty Hill star chart. God, what would that do?
Probably nothing.
She distanced herself from her family, spending more time with New Age groups and occult circles. She believed she had a greater mission, though she didn't yet know what it was. At some point, she visited a series of psychics, and according to reports, multiple psychics told her the same thing. You are about to meet a man who will change everything.
The most blasé, generic thing you could say to somebody.
I should have done that in the hag's voice. This man, they said, would be tall, fair-skinned, and have light-colored hair, like 85% of the population.
Yep.
He would be someone who needed guidance, someone who shared a divine purpose with her.
Oh, yeah.
And then, in March 1972, she met Marshall Applewhite. The details of how Applewhite and Nettles first met remain unclear. Some accounts suggest that he was visiting a friend in the hospital where Nettles worked as a nurse, while others claim that he was a psychiatric patient at the facility. What is undisputed is the instant connection they felt. Applewhite was emotionally broken, drowning in depression and confusion, searching for a purpose that made sense of his suffering. Nettles, with her spiritual certainty and unwavering conviction, provided something he had never experienced before. An explanation for everything that had happened to him. She told him their meeting was no coincidence. She said that their souls had known each other before, that they had been reunited in this lifetime for a mission beyond human comprehension. And Applewhite, desperate for meaning, believed her. Over the next several weeks, they spent hours talking, studying, and building a shared belief system. They combined Nettle's knowledge of astrology, mysticism, and divine communication with Applewhite's Christian upbringing and fascination with UFOs. Together, they came to a radical conclusion. They were not human at all.
Yeah, no shit.
Instead, they were divine beings sent to Earth to fulfill a prophecy.
Okay, then. I just think that's shit crazy.
From this moment on. From this moment. Never mind.
Oh, jeez.
Nettles and Applewhite were inseparable. They began calling themselves the Two, referencing the two witnesses from the Book of Revelation who were said to prophesy during the end times. Way to put yourself at the front of the story, people. So,
Catholicism doesn't deal with
New Testament.
Well, of course we do. We just don't deal with Revelation.
Not Revelation. So, it is said in the Book of Revelations, obviously. For those that don't know, Revelations is the book that is the end times. That there would be two witnesses that would bear prophecy during the end times, and they would bear witness to the fire falling from the sky, basically everything that happens during the end times, and that two prophets would stay and would bear witness to it all. And these two claim to be that too. So
yeah, talk about inserting yourself as the main character.
Main character energy.
I'm trying to find, because they had a specific verse in Revelation that they used.
Yeah, no, we never.
I think it was like Revelation 12.
Yeah, they used to get annoyed. The priests and everybody and the religious teachers when I went to school would get annoyed with us kids if we read Revelation. Mostly because they knew that, oh my God, the kids are reading Revelation. Now they're going to think that everything is end of the world, blah, blah, blah. No, it's not, blah, blah, blah.
When I was into all of that, I studied Revelations religiously. It's Revelations 11:3. God states he will empower two witnesses to prophesy for 1,260 days clothed in sackcloth, signifying a period of mourning and distress. And that is, actually, I'll read you. Yeah, that's the NIV version.
Yeah, we were encouraged to read.
And then it goes
Revelation.
Then it goes on to the woman and the dragon.
Yeah, we were actually, it was the opposite for us. We were encouraged not to read Revelation.
Yeah, well, being in a Bible-based church.
I mean, I've heard two arguments. One, I had one nun tell us kids, it was like, listen, it'll happen, and you're not going to be able to do anything about it, so just relax. Or two, I had one priest tell me that it's a lot of newer biblical scholars have, not very many, but some of them have believed that Revelation was meant for a different time. It was meant, when Revelation was written, it was written within the 50 to 100 years of Jesus' death. So everybody, when it was written, they all... Early Christians thought that the apocalypse would be within their lifetime. So they, because if you start comparing some of like the beasts, the symbols and everything to the Roman Empire and other powers in the area, they make more sense at that point than they do in like modern settings.
So do you know who wrote the Book of Revelation?
John, the Apostle John.
Yes, correct. So John was exiled on the island of Patmos.
Yes.
That's when he wrote Revelation. So Revelations 1 through 3 is the message to the seven churches.
Yes.
In Asia Minor. It basically represented the spiritual conditions of both ancient and future churches. Then 4 through 5 represented the throne room of heaven. John saw God on the throne and Jesus holding the scroll with seven seals. And then Revelation 6, 8 through 1 talks about the seven seals. So the white horse, the conquest, the red horse, the war, black horse famine, pale horse death, martyrs under the altar, cosmic disturbances such as earthquakes, sun, darkened stars fall, and then silence in heaven leading to the seven trumpets. And then Revelations 8 through 11 is the seven trumpets. Each trumpet brings a different plague. So I'm reading this now. I used to have all this memorized. Number one was hail and fire mixed with blood. Number two was mountain burning with fire thrown into the sea. Three is wormwood star poisons water. Four is sun, moon, and stars darkened. Five, abyss open and demonic locusts appear. Six is four angels release death upon one third of mankind. And seven is the kingdom of God proclaimed and final judgment begins. Then Revelations 12 through 14 is the mighty signs in heaven. This is where the two witnesses appear. The woman clothed with sun, seen as Israel or the church. There is the dragon, the woman and the dragon, which the dragon is supposed to be Satan. There is the beast from the sea, which is the Antichrist. There is the beast from the earth, which is the false prophet that is said to appear. Then there's the 144,000 sealed, and then the two witnesses who prophesy, perform miracles, and are killed by the beast. Then Revelations 15 through 16 goes through the seven bowls of wrath, which are the final judgment. So painful sores on beast followers. Sea becomes blood. Rivers become blood. Sun scorches people. Darkness on beast kingdom. Euphrates dries up, which is the beginning of Armageddon. And then earthquake and 100-pound hailstones.
100 pounds?
100-pound hailstones.
Damn. Good God.
Falling from the sky.
Also, then,
Revelation 17 through 18 is the fall of Babylon. So obviously Babylon the Great, it was a huge global power system, but very corrupt. It was the mother of prostitutes and abominations of the earth. And Babylon was going to fall. It was supposed to fall violently. And this is where what Ben said comes in, because obviously this doesn't exist anymore.
Nope.
Babylon's not there. So that's where what Ben, and then the final battle is Revelations 19 through 20, which is where Christ returns riding on a white horse, which is actually where I believe Gandalf coming back on a white horse was taken from.
I mean, that's kind of been a...
What people have thought.
That is, well, I mean, so Tolkien was Christian, and it's perfectly possible, but white horse steeds written by heroes that pops up in a lot of mythologies, both Christian and not Christian.
But so. It's what a lot of people believe, because it's exactly what it should be. And then the beast and false prophet are defeated, cast into the lake of fire. Satan's bound for 1,000 years, final judgment of the dead. And then you end with Revelations 21 through 22, which is where New Jerusalem descends. No more death, sorrow, or pain, and God dwells with humanity forever on earth.
Yes. So also, folks, just a little background on John the Apostle. He was also a poet.
Yeah.
So that was also another thing that was taught to me by about Revelation, is that John, the Apostle John, was a poet. So take everything that he said with a grain of salt, because if you are artistically inclined in creative writing, you can definitely see a hand of that in Revelation, because some of the stuff is a little, some poetic licensing was taken. Again.
And there's the Christians that believe that judgments are happening now.
You know what, though? Because, again, everything that has just been described, I can name at least three different instances in Europe, Africa, and the Middle East that could be easily akin to what was happening in Revelations. Rome, for example. Obviously, even back then, Babylon wasn't during Christ's time, Babylon was not technically the center of everything. In ancient Israel, yes. But by this point, Rome was the city. Yeah. So, and Rome could very easily be described
as the center of sin.
Exactly.
Rome was very sinful.
I can name at least three different instances in the history of Rome from the time of the empire, actually within the empire, where sudden cataclysmic events happened and Rome was destroyed, quote unquote. I can name a couple even after the Roman Empire fell.
Yeah,
there is so many plagues and everything that have happened. I think, me personally, before we get off, so we can get off this tangent, Revelations is great for describing whatever it is. It's very, very visual. But I think, was it Matthew something? I forget the name of it, where it says, you will hear of wars and rumors of wars, and all these things will come to pass. For the time of the final judgment is sent, and only, and not even the angels in heaven will know until God says so. I'm paraphrasing there, but essentially, nobody knows when it's going to end until only God knows. That's it. Things happen. It's going to happen. That's all. They all have to come and pass. So people who just want to focus on Revelation because it's the only part of the Bible that actually gives some detail of how it's all supposed to end. I'm using air quotes for that end.
So all of that to go back to what they believe, that they are the two witnesses of the book of Revelation.
Which, by the way, they're not.
They're not. So their teaching has evolved rapidly. Jesus had been an extraterrestrial sent to Earth to prepare humanity for ascension.
That's a big of a, bit of a leap.
The kingdom of heaven was actually a spacecraft, a higher dimension beyond human reach.
Okay.
The world was about to be recycled, and only those who followed their teachings could escape the coming destruction.
Will we be put in the plastic or paper bin? We're going to be recycled, it'll be plastic or paper. It's a legitimate question.
You would just be the garbage.
Wow.
No, I love you.
By 1973, they had abandoned their old lives entirely. Nettles left her family behind, cutting ties with her husband and children. Applewhite reinvented himself, shedding his past failures and stepping fully into his new role. They began traveling across the United States, spreading their message and seeking followers who were ready to join them in their diving mission. And people listened. Apparently it's a diving mission.
Are they scuba divers?
Yes. It's supposed to be divine mission, but it's apparently they're going diving.
Hey,
well, I mean, they were in Florida when this all happened, right?
Yeah.
Certain letters are very close to each other on the keyboard.
G and E are a little far away there.
Not really.
There's like...
There's a distinct...
There's R and D, R, and F between them. So...
My bad.
After their diving mission, people listened. Now that they are Navy SEALs, their unique blend of Christian millenarianism, UFO mythology, and New Age spirituality resonated with spiritual seekers, outcasts, and those looking for something beyond traditional religion. What began as two people on a quest was slowly becoming a movement of frogmen.
I am sorry I mistyped that. I remember when I was typing this, it was like 4 a.m. because I couldn't sleep.
Okay. I'm fine with it, honey. It's a mistake. I make all the time. All
right, let's dive back in.
Okay, babe, you need to proofread my stuff now because he's not letting me live this down anytime soon because this is the second one that I've fucked up.
Bonnie Nettles was more than just a co-leader of Heaven's Gate. She was its spiritual architect. Applewhite was the voice, but Nettles was the guide. He preached, but she interpreted the signs. He commanded loyalty, but she created the theology. It was her influence that pushed the group toward asceticism, and self-denial, leading them to reject personal relationships, sexuality, and material attachments. It was her mystical interpretations that convinced Applewhite that they were destined to leave Earth and ascend to the next level. Like I said, everything is her. If it weren't for her, none of this would have happened.
No, it wouldn't have, because Marsha would have probably still been
A psych patient.
Nettles would have probably found someone else that she could have hoodwinked and manipulated. Honestly, that's what it seems like, is that she manipulated Applewhite to do her bidding.
So, do you guys know what aestheticism is?
Yeah, it's the aesthetics, like the
fasting.
Oh, yeah.
Fasting, celibacy, all of that.
I was thinking of something else.
Sorry. What we know is, like in Christianity, the saints and early Christian monks practiced it, like the Desert Fathers, if you've ever heard of the Desert Fathers. The idea of it's to resist temptation of the flesh and draw closer to God. In the Bible, Jesus fasting for 40 days.
Yeah.
That's aestheticism. It's an ascetic act. And every religion has them. So, okay, so it was her mystical interpretations that convinced Applewhite that they were destined to leave Earth and ascend to the next level. And when she died of cancer in 1985, it shattered everything. Her death was not supposed to happen. They had believed they would both ascend physically together. With Nettles gone, Applewhite was left to redefine their teachings to fit the reality he refused to accept. Her death transformed Heaven's Gate into a doomsday cult, setting the stage for events that would unfold on March 1997. I will say, they were never, as far as we know, they were never romantically involved.
Oh, no. They
saw each other more as family than anything.
And if I understand Heaven's Gate, they really did, like, no sexual contact, no nothing. I
think it was
castrated themselves.
Yes.
That was after Nettles' death. Before Nettles' death, they were allowed to have relationships and stuff like that.
They couldn't have sex, though.
They couldn't have sex, but they were allowed to have relationships. After Nettles' death, they weren't allowed to have any romantic attachments whatsoever. And men went as far as going to Mexico to get themselves surgically castrated.
Bonnie Nettles was the true believer. The force that turned Marshall Applewhite from a broken man into a self-proclaimed prophet. Without her, Heaven's Gate never would have existed. But after she was gone, Applewhite had to carry their mission alone. And without her guidance, his descent into paranoia, control, and ultimate destruction accelerated. Now, by 1973... Marshall Applewhite and Bonnie Nettles had abandoned their old lives entirely. Their identities, families, and past no longer mattered. They believed they were divine beings sent on a mission to prepare humanity for an imminent transformation. No longer Marshall Applewhite and Bonnie Nettles, they adopted new names. Applewhite became Bo, later known as Doe, pronounced D-O-E, and Nettles became Peep, later known as T or T-E-E.
Pronounced T-E-E.
Correct. So they were Bo Peep, and then they became Doe-T. Stupid.
Yeah.
They're fucking idiots. They referred to themselves as the Two, believing that they were the two witnesses prophesied in the Book of Revelation. Their goal was to find others who were ready to transcend their human existence and guide them to the next level. A non-physical extraterrestrial realm where they would be transformed into perfected immortal beings. But to build a movement, they needed followers. For the next 2 years, Bo and Peep, which we're using those because they haven't changed their names yet, traveled the United States, spreading their teachings in bookstores, college campuses, New Age centers, and alternative spiritual communities. They used various recruitment stages. They used word-of-mouth networking. They connected with people through spiritual discussion groups and UFO meetups. They held gatherings in small towns, advertising through handwritten flyers and posters that invited people to learn about the next evolutionary step for mankind. They targeted individuals already involved in New Age movements, theosophy, and extraterrestrial belief systems. Their message was a fusion of Christian millenarianism, UFO mythology, and self-transformation. Sorry, that word's like a pain in the ass to say.
If I recall correctly, I'm looking up what that is, but it had something to do with like a lot of religious groups that are built around the new turning of the new millennium. Like the new millennium would be like the ushering in of like the revelation, everything from Revelations to a whole bunch of other, like the second coming of Christ.
Correct. So it's also called millennialism.
That's what I've heard.
So it's the belief that Jesus returns to earth, establish a 1,000-year reign of peace and righteousness, a millennium as described in the book of Revelation, which is Revelations 21-6. And just a cap, they came to life and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. They basically believe Christ's second coming will initiate a literal or symbolic 1,000-year reign. And during this time, Satan is bound and righteousness prevails, meaning that there's no sin at this point. And that's what they believe. It's kind of out there. So humanity is on the, this is their message. Humanity is on the brink of a massive transformation. The earth is about to be recycled, and only those who abandon their human attachments can ascend to the next level. We, Bo and Peep, have been sent from the higher realms to prepare the chosen ones for their departure. Those who listen will be taken aboard a spacecraft and transported to the kingdom of heaven. Those who remain attached to the world will be left behind. Listen. If they had chosen a different name other than Bo and Peep,
I might have got more people.
Like, you know, fucking nursery rhyme? Fucking Little Bo Peep? To some, their message was nonsensical, but to others, it was revolutionary. People were drawn in, intrigued by their calm yet commanding presence, their certainty, and their promise of escape from human suffering. Bo and Peep didn't just offer religion. They offered a new way of life, a radical rejection of society, and the possibility of leaving Earth entirely. And people believe them. I will tell you right now, if this happened again, these two, guarantee you we would see a lot of people take them.
Sure, yeah.
A lot of people would do
There's always people who will believe this kind of stuff.
The first major success came in May 1974 when a woman named Sharon Morgan abandoned her home and children to join them. Though she left the group a month later, her recruitment marked a turning point. They now had evidence that their teachings could convince people to walk away from their previous lives, including their fucking children.
That's the saddest part, is that they left their children.
Yeah. As sad as that is, the kids are probably better off if their parents are just going to do this.
You know, there's like no children in this cult.
Yeah, I know.
No children. It's all adults.
Yeah, I know. And honestly, God, as sad as this was, this whole story is, it is. Honestly, I think the kids got off easy, because imagine having to have these weak-willed parents as your parents.
You're watching your parents sit up on the edge of a fucking building waiting to jump off when a fucking ship is supposed to get them.
Yeah.
We actually see that in a few different TV shows. They actually take from this.
Oh yeah,
I believe it was in The Rookie.
It was in The Rookie.
That was based off of this.
Yeah, it was The Rookie. It was, I want to say, it might have been the missile episode.
Yeah, it was. One where they got
that. So that whole thing was based off of Heaven's Gate. But it was in 1975 that their movement truly began to grow. In April 1975, Bo and Peep held a large gathering in Studio City, Los Angeles. Among the 80 attendees, at least 25 people joined them on the spot, leaving behind their families, careers, and possessions. They continued their tour, traveling through California, Colorado, and Oregon, holding more meetings and gaining more followers. Their biggest recruitment event came in September 1975 in the small town of Waldport, Oregon. Bo and Peep arrived in Waldport, a quiet coastal town with a strong counterculture movement, which is why they picked it. They held a meeting at a local motel hall attended by about 200 people. The two leaders spoke in soft but confident tones, presenting themselves not as religious preachers but as messengers of higher knowledge. They told the audience that the earth was about to undergo a cataclysmic event, that they were representatives from the kingdom of heaven sent to gather the chosen few before the earth's recycling. And only those who abandoned their worldly attachments could be taken aboard the spacecraft that would transport them to the next level. That night, 20 people vanished. They sold all their belongings, left behind families, and joined Bo and Peep on their nomadic spiritual journey.
Again, I think the family's got the better end of this deal. I know that sounds harsh and everything, but
made a choice.
Yeah.
Like, I understand that, but it's still harsh to, like, it's like, fuck.
It is. It is. But the worst part is that, again, some two kooks named Bo and Peep show up and tell you all this. You're like, I must leave my wife, children, or my husband, children, and everything and leave. It's like, wow. Did you really just not care that much that two randos who just waltz into town one night and you're gone the morning? That's bad. I'm sorry. That's bad.
The sudden disappearance of these individuals triggered nationwide media coverage. Families and friends frantically searched for their loved ones. The story became so sensational that even CBS Evening News covered it, with Walter Cronkite reporting. A score of persons from a small Oregon town have disappeared. It's a mystery whether they've been taken on a so-called trip to eternity or simply been taken. I don't remember what Walter Cronkite sounds like, but we'll say it's that.
I can't really do it.
Yeah, it's beyond my time. For Bo and Peep, this was proof that their message was working. But with increased media attention came increased scrutiny. Local authorities and concerned families began searching for missing members, worried that something sinister was happening. The group, now numbering around 100 members, realized that they needed to disappear from the public view. So they did. From the Waldport disappearances, Heaven's Gate ceased public recruitment and became a closed, insular community. They abandoned public meetings, opting instead to move secretly across the country, living in makeshift camps, tents, and remote locations. They became hippies.
From the sound of it, about half of them were already hippies. Yeah.
They established strict rules. No personal relationships or emotional attachments. Friendships and romantic ties were discouraged to maintain total devotion to the mission. No contact with family or the outside world. They were told that their old lives were over. New identity system. Members were required to adopt new names, typically three letters, names ending in O-D-Y, like Jamodi, Rakodi, or Lavodi, symbolizing that they were children of the next level.
And just be aware that there's no vowels besides the O and the Y.
Correct. Well, Y is not a vowel.
Sometimes Y.
A-E-I-O-U.
And sometimes Y.
A-E-I-O-U. A focus on purification and discipline. The group adhered to a strict diet, celibacy, and a rejection of human desires. They moved from place to place, often sleeping in tents and eating collectively. They saw themselves as spiritual nomads preparing for their eventual departure from Earth. For almost a decade, Heaven's Gate remained hidden from public view. They lived in seclusion, waiting for the sign that it was time to ascend. But by the mid-1980s, their belief would be challenged in an unexpected way when Bonnie Nettles, the movement's spiritual architect, was diagnosed with cancer. Her death in 1985 would shake the foundation of their doctrine, forcing Applewhite to reshape the group's beliefs. By 1976, Heaven's Gate had transitioned from an open spiritual movement into a full-fledged reclusive cult. Bo and Peep had succeeded in convincing dozens of people to abandon their lives and their teachings, were becoming more rigid, more extreme, and more apocalyptic. But their next challenge would change everything. With Nettle's death in 1985, Applewhite had to rewrite their theology to account for something they never anticipated, the possibility that they wouldn't ascend in their physical bodies. This shift in doctrine would lead to the ultimate tragedy, the mass suicide of 1997.
And Bonnie died of melanoma, metastatic cancer to the liver.
Yeah, liver cancer.
So melanoma is skin cancer, though, right?
Did I pronounce it right?
Melanoma metastatic to the liver. Yeah, it's liver cancer. Typically, yes, melanoma is skin cancer. Well, melanoma metastatic, that means...
It was skin cancer, yeah.
Skin cancer that moved to the liver, yes. So, for over a decade, Bonnie Nettles and Marshall Applewhite had preached that their bodies were merely temporary vehicles meant to be transformed into perfected extraterrestrial forms when they ascended to the next level. But in 1985, everything changed. Nettles, the visionary force behind Heaven's Gate, the woman who had interpreted the celestial signs and guided Applewhite's spiritual awakening, was diagnosed with cancer. The prognosis was grim. She had an aggressive tumor behind her right eye, and despite medical intervention, the cancer quickly spread. Her illness shattered the very foundation of their belief system. Behind her right eye, she didn't see that one coming. Listen, she deserves it. They had always taught that their physical bodies would be taken aboard a spacecraft, where they would be transformed and granted immortality. Death wasn't part of the equation. They were supposed to leave Earth alive. But on June 19th, 1985, Bonnie Nettles died in a hospital in Dallas, Texas at the age of 57. Her body was not taken up into a spaceship. There was no transformation, no ascension, no sign of extraterrestrial intervention. Applewhite was devastated, but more than that, he was terrified. Everything they had believed, everything they had taught, was now in serious doubt. And so Applewhite did what all great cult leaders do when confronted with a contradiction in their prophecy. He rewrote the doctrine.
And he got even more strict than what they had.
Yeah. After Nettles' death, Applewhite was left alone at the helm of Heaven's Gate. For a short time, the group was paralyzed. Some members questioned their faith. If T was the higher authority and had died, what did that mean for the mission? Had they been wrong? Had she failed? Applewhite couldn't allow doubt to spread. He had to adapt the teachings to account for this unexpected event. And in doing so, he cemented his control over the group like never before. And here's his revised doctrine. T had not died. She had exited her vehicle. He told the group that Nettles' physical body was merely a temporary shell and that her soul had successfully been transported to the next level. She had shed her human form and continued the mission from above, preparing the way for the rest of them. The next level was no longer about taking your body with you. Originally, they had believed that a UFO would physically collect them, transforming their human forms into perfected extraterrestrial beings. Now, Applewhite claimed that the soul could ascend even if the body remained behind. This change meant that death was now a necessary step in their journey. He was now the sole representative of the next level. Before, Nettles and Applewhite had been equal co-leaders with T as the spiritual authority. Now that she was gone, Applewhite fully stepped into the role of absolute leader. He had told followers that T had been God the Father in human form, and that she had left him behind to complete the mission. New focus on preparing for departure. The group became more rigid, ascetic, and secluded. Applewhite preached that they had limited time left on Earth and that they had to purify themselves to be ready when their time came. This shift accelerated the group's descent into extremism. What had once been a spiritual movement with vague UFO beliefs was not a doomsday cult. Fully committed to the idea that leaving the human body was the only way to reach salvation.
Yes, they did. He did say that Nettles was God the Father,
yep,
and switched from she to he.
He had to
make this, if nothing more, for his own mind was probably broken by this. He probably had to make it make sense to himself as well, as much as his followers.
Yeah. So with Nettles gone, Heaven's Gate became even more secretive and withdrawn from the outside world. Members were required to reject all human attachments, no family, no friends, no personal ambitions. They already had that. But this time they were adopting strict identical clothing styles. And I'm sorry, not just clothing. They had to have the same haircut. They all had bowl cuts.
And at first it was no family, no friends. Now it's no personal ambition. They can't do shit. Because I believe before they could have jobs outside of the group. Now it was only if strictly necessary.
Identical clothing, identical haircuts. They all had bowl cuts. Except for Doe, because he was losing his hair. He was going bald. So he eventually he goes from that to that. But looking at him, you can tell he's a psycho.
Oh yeah.
So romantic relationships and sexual activity were banned. Applewhite increasingly saw sexuality as an obstacle to spiritual evolution, mostly because he couldn't have sex with dudes. Members gave up their names, adopting new identities, ending in ODY, Jamodi, Rakoti, symbolizing that they were children of the next level, same as before, and their diet was controlled now. Sometimes consisting only of liquids or bland restrictive meals designed to remove human indulgence, like plain oats. Like just plain oatmeal, no nothing.
It was to prepare them for the next level because apparently aliens don't know how to
season food.
I mean, white people barely know how to season food, let alone aliens.
So that's Ben, not me.
Wow, I actually know how. You are not about to talk to say that I don't know how to season foods. How much milk did you have today with the bratwurst we had?
That's because it was you didn't season it. Kate did.
It wasn't that spicy at all.
Okay. I have a basic white girl spice level tolerance.
Applewhite, already obsessed with eliminating human desires, began preaching that sexuality itself was a trap designed to keep them tied to Earth. I guess I'm staying on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
He claimed that in the next level, beings had no gender and no reproductive organs. 8 male members, including Applewhite himself, voluntarily underwent surgical castration to demonstrate their devotion. The procedure, which was first attempted by a member with no medical training, nearly resulted in death. After this, they traveled to Mexico for professional surgeries. This extreme control and isolation reinforced the idea that they were no longer human. They were evolving into something higher, leaving their mammalian weaknesses behind. In the early 1990s, the group embraced a new strategy for survival, technology. They started a web design business called Higher Source, which offered professional website creation services. This provided funding for the group. It also gave them access to the growing digital world, allowing them to spread their message more effectively. Their website, heavensgate.com, became their digital pulpit, explaining their teachings to an entirely new audience, which is still used. They used Usenet message boards and email newsletters to recruit new followers. This was one of the first known examples of a religious cult fully integrating itself into the internet. However, Applewhite began to feel time was running out. In 1996, Heaven's Gate came across a story that aligned perfectly with their beliefs. A story that convinced Applewhite that their final departure was imminent. That story was about Comet Hale-Bopp. In conclusion, the death of Bonnie Nettles in 1985 was a turning point that transformed Heaven's Gate from a cult waiting for salvation to a cult actively preparing for their own deaths. Marshall Applewhite had successfully rewritten their theology to account for her passing, shifting their belief system from physical ascension to soul-based departure. He had eliminated sexuality, identity, and individuality from his followers, turning them into pure, obedient disciples. And now, with the rise of the internet, he had the ability to spread his message further than before. But when Comet Hale-Bopp appeared in 1996, Applewhite became convinced that this was the sign they had been waiting for, the final opportunity to exit Earth before it was too late. Their mission was nearly complete, and in March 1997, it would come to its horrifying conclusion. And in the next episode, we explore the final months of Heaven's Gate, their preparations for departure, their chilling farewell videos, and the tragic mass suicide that shocked the world. Any last-minute statements?
Batshit fucking crazy.
Yep, pretty much.
I just feel bad for all the, like, families that were left behind.
Yeah, I mean...
Well, it isn't touched on, but one of the members was actually, what's her name? Uhura from Star Trek.
Oh,
original. Yeah.
Yeah.
Her brother was part of this. That
he was one of the ones that died.
Yep.
That's terrible.
I read that. I'm like, oh shit.
So, with that, we want to thank you for listening. Please remember to turn in your glasses, push in your seat, and as always, tip the bard. Good night, everybody.
Good night. Clink.
Clink.